Fasten your seatbelts and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. Aldo Leopold wrote, "Conservation is a state of harmony between men and land." John Muir said, "The practical importance of the preservation of our forests is augmented by their relations to climate, soil, and streams." Leopold and Muir were two of our country's giants in the study and practice of conservation. Both had very deep roots in Wisconsin. And because of their influence, many consider Wisconsin as the birthplace of the conservation movement. Today on Route 51, we explore the past, present, and future of conservation in Wisconsin. How is Leopold's land ethic relevant today? How can we honor the legacies of our state's environmental pioneers while balancing economic development priorities? What can we expect under Governor Evers' administration? We'll dive into these questions and more with our guest and you. You can participate at 800-780-9742. That number again is 800-780-9742. Or email route51@wpr.org. Let me introduce our guest. Bill Berry is a longtime Central Wisconsin environmental journalist, author, and conservation communicator for national organizations. He is a state columnist for the Capital Times, where his column appears regularly. He got a start in journalism with the Wausau Daily Herald. His first big environmental story was a series about nitrate contamination of Central Wisconsin wells. His 2014 book, Banning DDT, How Citizen Activists in Wisconsin Led the Way, won an award from the Midwest Independent Publishers Association as Nature Book of the Year in 2014. He's tromped around the rivers, lakes, and woodlands of central Wisconsin for most of his adult life. He and his wife live in Stevens Point. Bill Berry, welcome back to Route 51.
Thanks a lot, Rick. Good to be here and good to join you.
Bill, what inspired you to a career in environmental journalism and conservation writing?
Well, probably several things, Rick. I might start with I grew up in Green Bay on East Mason Street, eight blocks downwind from the Fox River, which was one of the most polluted rivers in America and one of the top Superfund sites, as it turns out. Then I went on to college at River Falls, where I fell in love with the Kinignik River, the great trout stream there, and my friends took me out there and showed me around, and pretty soon I found myself really being interested in environmental issues. And when I had the chance to work at the Daily Herald here many, many years ago, at one point I was actually an environmental reporter. It was my main beat. They had a full newsroom of people, and we even had an outdoor reporter. We had an outdoor reporter, Jim Lee, and I got to be an environmental reporter. What fun that was.
I remember you writing then, and I also remember Jim's writing. I always look forward to that. In the foreword of a Sand County Almanac, Leopold writes, "When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect." What does that mean to you?
Well, to me, that is, in a nutshell, the whole description of ecological science. I mean, everything's interconnected, as John Muir said. And the first rule of intelligent tinkering is to save all the parts, said Aldo Leopold. And I think that's what we've learned from ecological science over time, is that it is all connected, and we are part of that. We are part of that community. Some of us view ourselves at the top of the chain of the community. Others think we're part and parcel to it, but we certainly are part of that whole land community.
What is your perspective on how our society as a whole view Leopold's land ethic today, and are people even aware that that ethic is still there?
That's a really good question, Rick. I've traveled around the country working for conservation groups, and Leopold's name comes up frequently. But it's almost – sometimes I think it's almost to remind us that he's out there and that his wisdom is still with us. It's a good question that I think the answer is he's kind of like a voice in the wilderness in some ways. Other events have overtaken us over time, and we need to go back to Aldo Leopold. I see right here on your council you have a copy of his book. I think many people in Wisconsin have a copy of it on their nightstands, and that's where it belongs.
Exactly. I've had that book since, the early 80s. Yeah. Incredible book. And he wrote that It was published just after he passed away in 1948, 49.
It was. As a matter of fact, he learned that his book was accepted for publication, and then very shortly after that, he died. So his assistant, Joseph Hickey, who was a prominent person in the DDT book I wrote, a wildlife biologist at Madison, sort of helped us see the publication through its final stages. So, interesting story.
Is there... Do you see that conservation issues and in writings of Leopold and John Muir and others, do you see that as something in our schools that's missing? Do you see an opportunity where our educational system can adopt more of that that type of writing? And actually, not just the writing, but the conservation land ethic.
Again, an interesting question. I think it depends on the school and the teacher. I think some of them are totally inspired as part of our Wisconsin history lessons, and I think fourth grade is required in the state. Certainly should have some conservation education components there. And I think many teachers do. Do we have enough? We can never have enough conservation. I've always heard that there's a great interest in the environment. It's very broad, but it's sometimes as deep as a puddle.
That's interesting response to that. Tell us more about Wisconsin's legacy as it comes to conservation.
Well, you've mentioned a couple of the key characters there, obviously John Muir and although Leopold. There are many others. Charles Van Hise, who was the president of the University of Wisconsin right at the turn of the last century, was a huge figure in our history. We went on through a number of citizen activists over the years who really sort of followed in the footsteps of Muir and Leopold. And the list is endless of people who have been involved, made big contributions or small contributions. I think of those in central Wisconsin. I think of a woman, Bertha Pearson, who I was able to feature in my DDT book, who was a officer with Marathon Box Company, a citizen activist who... helped establish the Visiting Nurses Association here and the Hom Home for Boys in Wittenberg. She was a dedicated conservationist and a true leader with the group called Citizens Natural Resources Association, which initiated a lot of activity. So we have it right here in our own home here in central Wisconsin. Another figure, Al Berkman, who was a soil conservation service technician for many years in Wausau, tremendous leader. You could go on and on with people like that, Rick. It's been a rich legacy, and it's fun to sort of follow it and to know a little bit about it.
Well, you mentioned one of the pioneers or women in the field of conservation. Other ones that people may not be aware of that come to your mind right now?
Well, in the ranks of women who've been involved in conservation, it goes back across the last century, but I think it really blossomed in about the 1960s at the so-called start of the so-called modern environmental era, where women really began to step up and become leaders in the conservation movement here in Wisconsin. I think automatically of Lori Otto, a housewife from Bayfield, a Milwaukee suburb, who was a major environmental figure, one of the people who was credited with establishing the natural landscape movement, who fought pollution and who was just tireless in her efforts. So there's a whole host of women in similar positions in cities like Madison and Green Bay. I mentioned Bertha Pearson, who was just a real star in my mind. I'd like to know more about her. There's a limited amount of information about her. But, women emerged in the 1960s in leadership roles, and it's continued to be that way. You take schools like the College of Natural Resources at UW-Stevens Point, a high number of, I think, even more women graduates right now than men. So in a field that had been primarily dominated by men for many years is now much more diverse.
In Wisconsin, some of our political leaders in the past, Gaylord Nelson and Warren Knowles, are some of the obvious names that come forward right away. They did quite a bit for Wisconsin, getting Wisconsin's name out there as a conservation juggernaut, if you will. But do you think over time people have taken our Wisconsin conservation legacy for granted?
Yes, I do. I think we need to constantly renew our knowledge and interest in topics, and the conservation world has run into some tough times for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is we have tremendous budget restraints in both the state and the country. And so we need to find out where conservation fits as a priority. Gaylord Nelson was certainly an inspiration. He wasn't by far the only one of that time. I mean, we had a number of Wisconsin representatives who were actively involved with promoting conservation, including people like Dave Obie and Walter John Chilson before him at the state level here. These are people who sort of didn't have their political ideologies interfere with what they knew was right for our land and water resources. And it was a bipartisan thing.
Do you see that opportunity available to us now or in the future?
Well, I think we're going to find out real quickly because, as you know, Rick, just in the past couple of weeks, gosh, we've had a whole number of environmental stories that have jumped to the forefront both at the state and national level, and we're going to find out. We have an opportunity in Wisconsin in a couple of areas. I think we'll probably talk about them, but I have hope. I have hope that that we have enough leadership in both parties that we can find a way to get some of our most vexing problems addressed.
You're listening to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rick Ryer with conservation writer Bill Berry. When we do come back, we'll talk about water and other issues in today's political climate. And we'd like to hear from you as well. What's on your mind as it relates to conservation and the environment here in our state? Join the conversation at 800-780-9742. Again, that number to join us is 800-780-9742. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wind is the whisper of our mother, the earth. Wind is the hand of our Father, the sky. Wind watches over our struggles and pleasures. The wind is a goddess who first learned to fly.
Talking with conservation writer Bill Berry on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer. What are your perspectives on conservation issues in Wisconsin? 800-780-9742, the number to call. Again, that's 800-780-9742. And you can also send us an email at route51@wpr.org. In his State of the State address, Governor Tony Evers declared 2019 the year of clean drinking water. This week, the Wisconsin State Journal reported Evers will call for allowing state environmental and agricultural officials to borrow nearly $70 million more over the next 2 years to combat water pollution and replace lead pipes in his first budget address later this month. At the same time, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has formed his own water quality task force that will look at drafting bills addressing the same issues. Bill, how do you see this all shaking out?
Well, my hope would be that that we get through these stages quickly and get to what we really need to be, which is thanks to the governor for the proposal on the $70 million in bonding, and to Assembly Speaker Voss for his efforts. But we need a lot more than that to deal with the water quality issues in Wisconsin. And 1 in 10 private wells in Wisconsin is contaminated. There's 800,000 private wells in the state. 1 in 10 of them that we know of is contaminated. We can go on and on. In northeast Wisconsin, 40% of the wells have either bacteria or nitrates or other contaminants in them. Southwest Wisconsin, a recent study which shows that, goodness gracious, huge percentage of wells tested in the three-county area down there are contaminated. It seems to be oozing across the state, Rick, and I hope it's not the new normal.
That's That's a good hope to have. I agree with you there. Now, of course, water issues are a huge top priority in Wisconsin, have been for quite some time. In the northeast part of the state, there's been some special rules enacted. What do these rules address? And in your opinion, should they be expanded or similar rules be expanded to other parts of the state or statewide as a whole?
Well, credit to the previous governor and legislature for recognizing the depth of that problem there in northeast Wisconsin and establishing helping to create a set of rules that will hopefully address some of the contamination in northeastern Wisconsin in that fragile karst topography soil. That's a fancy word for soil with a bunch of cracks in it, and if water reaches those cracks, it goes straight down. And so the new rules are meant to address the manure spreading and manure handling in this area. One expert described as the worst place you could think of to put large animal confinement facilities. Unfortunately, we have a number of them. We have five times as many cows, for instance, in Kewaunee County, one of the most problemsome counties, as we do humans. However, septic systems are causing problems there too. So the steps that we've taken in northeastern Wisconsin that have yet to be implemented are still in the rulemaking process there, developing these rules. I think they may provide guidelines for us in other areas too. There's been a hesitancy to extend them past northeast Wisconsin, but I'm hopeful that when we find that they can work elsewhere, that we'll use them.
Here in central Wisconsin, of course, nitrates has been the big issue, nitrates in the water itself. And that's what you wrote on when you were with the Wausau Daily Herald and actually pretty much what you became known for back at that time. That was quite a while ago, and that's still a top issue today. What's being done now to address the issue, and what really needs to be done?
Well, unfortunately, nitrate levels have continued to rise, Rick, throughout this region in central Wisconsin. We have several communities, I think of Whiting and Plover in Portage County, that have long had to treat their drinking water for nitrates with costly reverse osmosis or ionization systems, whatever systems are used that help to diminish the percentages of nitrates in the water. It's a serious issue, and research is emerging to show that, you know, we used to say that nitrates are bad because a baby that was exposed to it at 6 months would get baby syndrome. We're now learning that there's some connections to some other very serious health issues that we really ought to pay careful attention to. I don't know how to fix that one. It's a combination of perhaps different agronomic practices and better management of our private septic systems. They're both part of the problem.
There's a symposium coming up at UW-Stevens Point in April, pretty much geared towards funding water quality issues. Tell us about the conference and what is the primary source of funding right now, and what are some options that they might be looking at the symposium?
Well, thanks for bringing it up, Rick. On April 24th, the UW-Stevens Point College of Natural Resources and an organization of which I'm a board member called the Ralph K. Morris Foundation. It's a foundation based in Minnesota, primarily to support the education of new cooperative leaders and also new leaders in the area of land and water sustainability. So we're having a symposium there, our second that we've had. The last one we had last year was very well attended. What we're going to look at here, and this is something that I think is going to be a topic that you're going to hear more about, is alternative funding to address these serious water quality issues. So the new normal is not the new normal. So we can deal with it with programs that provide long-term funding. The governor's proposal is for 2 years, $70 million. If we look across the border over at our sister state in Minnesota, they have a thing, a fund called the Legacy Fund, which is supported by a small percentage of their sales tax, and it provides funding for a variety of areas of interest. One of them, clean water, about $210 or more million dollars a year specifically for water quality. So that is a model that several people in Wisconsin who have been following this topic are really interested in, and we'll see. It would take the will of the public to make it happen.
No, that actually is changed the state constitution in Minnesota to create this amendment specifically for these issues and water quality and other things in the state. here in Wisconsin, back in 1989, the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program was developed to preserve natural areas and wildlife habitat, protect water and fisheries, and expand opportunities for outdoor recreation. The fund is used in part to purchase land for conservation and recreational needs. In fact, as of 2010, the fund has protected more than 600,000 acres. How does the Wisconsin DNR typically go about purchasing land, and what criteria is used in that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there are several aspects of that stewardship fund. There is the state purchasing ability, and I think the best examples of that, Rick, are some of the working forest lands that we've managed to preserve in northern Wisconsin. These are forest lands that maybe once were owned by paper mills, and they've since divested. And the danger is, of course, that as they divest, that the land becomes fragmented and we lose the capacity and ability to have large forest tracts that provide an array of benefits, multiple benefits from the wood industry perspective, from wildlife, from water quality, and from recreation. So that fund, in that sense, has been very valuable to preserve large tracts of land. I think of the Willow Flowage, which I think the stewardship fund was able to set aside, and that's just one example of many. The fund is also used where local land trusts, such as the North Central Conservancy Trust, are able to use stewardship funds to partner with their funds and other resources to protect tracts of property that individuals may decide that they want to preserve for perpetuity. So there's a couple aspects of it, and it's a pretty important fund also.
And that's really set to expire in 2020.
Yes, it is.
And it's up for reauthorization. How should this be a priority for the state budget?
Well, you know, these are difficult issues. I don't envy the people who have to make these decisions because, I mean, you're balancing the need for funding for public education, higher education, for health care, all of these matters, you know. And I will say that in Wisconsin, part of our legacy is our natural resource legacy, and the stewardship fund – the Bipartisan Stewardship Fund has been one of the tools that we've used, not the only tool, and it shouldn't be viewed as the only tool. My fear is that sometimes when we're in this moment where we've got so much thrown at the legislature and it comes down to what do you want? Do you want the stewardship fund or do you want a clean water fund? Or we don't want to be fighting against one another. We need to find a way to make it work in these key areas where we have priorities. And water quality is a huge priority right now, Rick.
Indeed. And how do we balance these priorities, the environmental, the water quality, the land, that priority with priorities in business, agriculture, and transportation? How do we bring that all together and create a balance, not just from a budget standpoint? Obviously, that's the critical point right there, but from a more bipartisan or philosophical standpoint, how do we bring these people together, these industries, conservationists and so on, and create a balance in addressing the needs of all?
Well, I guess that's an ongoing struggle. I don't know if a struggle or ongoing challenge, Rick. And you know, the work of conservation is never going to be done. And so we can't say, well, we got to this point and on to something else. It has to be part of the matrix of what we do in this state. And I'm not saying it's the most important thing, although I think it's pretty important for every resident of the state to be able to drink clean and safe drinking water. And in many cases, it's a matter of environmental justice because there are people who simply cannot afford the costly private systems that are used to mitigate the impacts of nitrates and other toxic substances that reach our water supplies. So it is a balancing act. I remember a study done by the Nature Conservancy a number of years ago that said that it was clear that the vast majority of Americans agreed that the quality of our water and our land resources is a major priority for them. What came down to the differences is how we got there. How do we fund these things? Some people believe the private sector can do it. Others think the public sector can do it. I think there's room for both.
Do you think voters in Wisconsin would like to see something to similar to what's happening in Minnesota?
I would like to see us take a shot at it. I sure would. I think it's getting to be far past the time of talking about it and time to take action. The Legacy Fund is by no means, in Minnesota, is by no means the only tool that's used to fund water quality and related issues, but it's one that's a model that we could look at. It would take, I think, if you change the Constitution in the state, Rick, I think you have to have two swings at it by the voting public, and then the legislature has to go ahead and take the steps in that direction. So it's a long process. We don't have the initiative process here where voters, like in California, can, by fiat, declare something. A little bit more complicated here in old Wisconsin.
Well, that's true. We're complicated in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, well, that's because our minds are so impacted by shoveling and blowing snow day after day.
Now, kind of going back to the governor's proposal with the $70 million in addition for the two-year funding, the Wisconsin DNR will be allowed to bond for an additional $65 million, and that would be going toward grants for local governments to reduce pollution and contaminated soil along the Milwaukee and St. Louis rivers, and as well as loaning to municipalities to cover the cost of replacing lead pipes. We didn't even talk about the lead pipe issue. I'm not as familiar with that as you probably are.
Well, I'm probably not as familiar with it as I ought to be, although I did read just a couple of days ago that 81 communities in Wisconsin have some sort of a lead abatement problem. That's 81 communities' water systems in the state, a variety of sizes. So it's obviously an issue. I'm reminded, you know, one of my heroes in the environmental movement for years was Byron Shaw, a researcher at UW-Stevens Point, who was instrumental in identifying acid rain as a problem in Wisconsin, and who was among the first to note that chemicals were moving quickly to groundwater in the porous sands of the Central Sands. And I remember Byron at a public meeting once saying, you know, these are all important problems, but who knows, maybe the worst of all is lead in our pipes. And so this was in the 1980s. We knew about it then, and I guess some things take time to fix.
Good things take time to fix. That is true. What can an average citizen, person listening right now, do to encourage progress in this in these areas of clean water, lead abatement, but primarily clean water? What can the average person do?
Well, first is become informed. And there's plenty of sources out there, programs like yours and other media in Wisconsin. I think of the Center for Investigative Journalism, which has done tremendous work out of Madison on these topics. So you need to become informed on it. And we need to return to the sort of idea that decisions we made are based on facts. I was on a panel several months ago on the future of science and policy in Wisconsin, and one of the presenters said, we used to live in an age when people said, I know something, and that's what they said. Now people say, I believe, rather than I know. We need to get back to knowing the facts, and science takes us there.
You're listening to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rick Ryer with conservation writer Bill Berry. When we come back, we'll talk about climate and the private lands conservation movement. And we're also going to take a look at the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame, something that Bill is very familiar with. We'd like to hear from you as well. Join the conversation at 800-780-9742. Again, that number is 1-800-780-9742. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Sometimes I wish I was a leaf. Sometimes I wish I was a tall tree. Sometimes I wish I was a deep sea swimmer. Sometimes I wish I was a rat. Sometimes I wish I was a tall corn stalk. Sometimes I wish to be anything I'm not.
paradise and put up a parking lot. With a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? It'd be a paradise and put up a parking lot.
We're talking with conservation writer Bill Berry on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer. What are your perspectives on conservation issues in the Badger State? Call us at 800-780-9742 or send us an email at route51@wpr.org. Last year, extreme flooding in southern Wisconsin reached record levels, overflowing levees, closing roads, damaging homes, and forcing evacuation. In September, Wisconsin officials estimated the damage of at least $44 million to public infrastructure. More recently, extreme temperatures and snowfalls shut down much of the state. Bill, how are local communities addressing conservation strategies to improve resilience to such extreme conditions?
Not very well, Rick, and I think anyone will tell you that. There are some examples of where communities are beginning the process of looking at their infrastructure. I hate to say Dane County, but that's one that comes to mind that has really taken this on, and they've actually have a climate resiliency staff person in their county. There's an awful lot of interest right now in southwest Wisconsin where you mentioned that horrendous flooding in August. And where something like seven water control structures, PL-566 dams, as they're called, were blown out by that tremendous event, and so I think there's a lot of interest in the areas where they've been hit the hardest, and I think you'll see it grow, and I hope that with the governor proclaiming his interest in this area, that we might see some acceleration of these considerations, because they mean a lot to people in terms of dollars and cents and lives lost.
And changes to the actual physical environment, especially with the floods that we experienced. How are farmers addressing these same issues?
Good question. I was able last week at this time. I was conducting some focus groups with farmers from across the country. It was a real eye-opening experience for me. About 25 farmers from a variety of places in this country, and they're all what we call soil health farmers. These are the people who've adopted some of the regenerative soil practices that address the resilience of their operations in times like this. And virtually to a person, we're talking about 25 farmers from all across the country. Every one of them said they have seen dramatic changes in weather in the recent decade. And we're talking about major rainfalls. We're talking about drought. We're talking about rain coming at the wrong time and drought coming at the wrong time. We're talking about weather extremes that affect productivity. Not a single one of them said it wasn't happening. This is something that's changed. Over time, the agricultural community, which is closest to land, has come to realize that there's something happening out there.
Well, that not only affects agriculture, it affects a lot of different industries, especially the fisheries industry throughout Wisconsin and around the world specifically. But here in Wisconsin, there's a conference coming up that is sponsored by the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service, the Citizens Climate Lobby, and it's called Wisconsin's Fish Are in Hot Water. Bill, would you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I'm going to learn a lot more about it after I attend the session, but I know enough about it to perhaps shed some light on it. Fisheries biologist, retired fisheries biologist Frank Pratt from the DNR is the presenter. And I think there are three programs, right, Rick? One on the 26th of February at UW Center here at 7 p.m., one on the 27th at 6:30 p.m. at Mead Wildlife Center, and another on February 28th at 6 p.m. at the Scott Free Library in Merrill. Pratt's contention is that the warming of our waters, our lakes in northern Wisconsin in particular, are jeopardizing signature fish populations such as walleye. And we're going to learn more from him him about that. We know for a fact that minor changes in water temperature and other factors can have dramatic impacts on not only on fish species, but on the macro and microinvertebrates that they feed on. And so I'm very interested to learn more from him. There are others who are experts on the forest ecology of the North and talk about how that can change in the future too. And so these are educational opportunities for people, and especially if you're interested in that walleye, favorite walleye spot of yours in northern Wisconsin, you might want to catch Frank Pratt's presentation to learn a little bit more about that.
Thinking about environment as it is today, thinking about not only the physical environment but the political environment, the environment in the conservation movement, if there was one thing that you would want people to really think about and consider as they go about their daily lives, what would that be?
Well, I first of all would want folks to consider what they can do on a personal level. This is just common sense. This is I call myself a conservative conservationist because I look at each day in a way that I hope I can minimize my own impact on the environment and maybe work to improve it. But I think more than anything else, what we need right now is a return to the appreciation for the messages that science brings us, the lesson that science can bring us. Science is not immutable. It changes, and that's probably one of its PR problems is that science does change. That's the nature of what it is. But I think we've got some real opportunities, and I always say that in most of these matters, such as water quality, we have all the tools we need to fix this, Rick. We just need the societal will. We need the will of the people to do so.
And some of those people that are very involved in science, in conservation movement, past, present, and future, we hope, will be addressed and honored, some of the folks, at the upcoming Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame induction ceremony. But you sit on the Board of Governors of the Hall of Fame. Is that correct, Bill?
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about the organization, its purpose and legacy.
Well, the organization was created by two dear friends of mine in 1985, the late Dan Trainer, who was the Dean of College of Natural Resources at UW-Stevens Point, and Bill Horvath, who was a longtime conservation professional and community activist in the Stevens Point area. It was their idea to get it going, and it's existed ever since then. They've managed to induct just short of 90, I think 88 people into the Conservation Hall of Fame. They have an annual ceremony. They have some exhibits and other displays at Schmeichel Reserve Visitor Center in Stevens Point. And I was able to, for years, write biographies of candidates for induction. Since then, I moved over to that Board of Governors, which is sort of a neutral body tries to assess the contributions of those who are nominated and make a judgment about who might, maybe, should be inducted. The group is the Conservation Hall of Fame is supported by 32 statewide conservation organizations, and they all bring something to the table, and it's a great opportunity to really really raise attention to work that a lot of our conservation leaders have done. Not everybody's an Aldo Leopold or a John Muir, but we've had an awful lot of people who have made big contributions over the years.
Well, tell us about the three that are being inducted this year.
Well, the three in this year are all of them have special stories. I'm particular to Don Johnson, the journalist from the Milwaukee Sentinel who passed away in 2006. And Don was from that long line of strong outdoor writers that emanated out of those Milwaukee papers and gave lessons to the rest of us about how to do our job. Don was not only interested in the hunting and fishing stories of Wisconsin, but he's also deeply interested in the environmental stories that there were to cover, and he did so. Big impact on the DDT story. He uncovered some information about that was very crucial at the time, and just had a huge role in a variety of ways. And sort of like I said, for young journalists who were coming up the ladder, they were a great inspiration. Others who are being inducted. Many of you recognize the name Scott Craven from his work with Extension and Public Radio and Madison, the wildlife expert who can tell you exactly how to get those bats out of your attic, right? And he touched the lives of tens of thousands of people through his education, extension education work, and his work as a wildlife professor there. Richly deserved. And gosh, I can't tell you how many times I listened to Scott Craven tell me about the things that I always wondered about out there in our outdoors. And of course, the third person being inductive is a woman who has been long gone, but who had a major impact. Her name was Arlene Schmidt. Her name is spelled A-R-O-L-I-N-E, and it's pronounced Arlene. And she was a forest activist, a citizen activist who worked in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. She had a number of physical health issues, but it didn't stop her from engaging people right to the top of agencies across the country. She was very direct in her demands of them, and another example of an early woman pioneer in the world of conservation. Three really worthy figures, and fortunately, Scott Craven is alive, and he will be there, so sometimes there's a criticism that the Conservation Hall sometimes waits until people die before they put them into the hall, and you know, I have to say, part of that is that people don't think about all the contributions others have made until that stage of life. And I have to say that, I have to say just briefly how much I appreciate all the work that Glenn Moberg did here at this particular station. And I know Glenn was dramatically interested in the environment and covered it heavily throughout his time here. And so these are the kinds of people who deserve recognition for their work.
Oh, I certainly appreciate that, Bill. The Hall of Fame also has a very very nice visitor center and museum located in the Schmeichle Reserve on the UW-Stevens Point campus. Tell us about the museum itself. I find it fascinating myself.
Yeah, well, that was, again, the work of those original founders who scraped up enough money from organizations in the private sector and the public sector to put together a pretty nice little museum. And it also includes the plaques of all those who have been inducted into the Hall of Fame. And the beauty of it is it's located in that island of green, that, as they call it, in Stevens Point Schmeichle Reserve, which has walking and hiking or hiking and biking trails throughout. A great experience. There's also a great little browse shop there. If you're looking for some really good environmental topics, they have a pretty good little library there too. I would be remiss if I didn't say that the university itself has been a long supporter of the cause of conservation. The College of Natural Resources there is the largest of its kind of the undergraduate College of Natural Resources in the country. You turn out professionals all across the country. And its dean is Christine Thomas, a longtime faculty member there who has gone on to do great things both at the college and throughout the conservation world.
And the induction ceremony is April 13th at Century World in the atrium, and that's in Stevens Point. More information about the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame is at wchf.org. And another series of events coming up related to the person we started the program off with, Aldo Leopold. Aldo Leopold Week and Weekend starting March 1st and running through March 9th. And that's happening not only here in Wisconsin, but all across the United States. And are you aware of any specific events, Bill, that are happening in not only Wisconsin, but right here in the central part of the state?
You know, I am not. I'm woefully uninformed on that. I know that there are some events there at the Aldo Leopold Center, where the Aldo Leopold Foundation is located in near Baraboo, and that is worth a visit for people in itself. It's a gorgeous structure and a high green tier and a very well done and use of renewable materials and all. And it's just a hop, skip, and jump from obviously the Aldo Leopold Shack. I know that in previous years there have been readings at a number of locations, and you may know a little more about that than I do, Rick. But I know that the Leopold Foundation has the information on its website about activities, and maybe you know more than I do on that topic.
That would be aldoleopold.org. And again, that's March 1st through the 9th. Any last comments or thoughts before we end the program this morning related to your thoughts and as far as the administration, new administration here in the State House or anything else related to conservation ethics here in this state?
Well, I'm hopeful, and I'm hopeful on the water quality front with the governor's initiative and also Assembly Speaker Voss's initiative. You know, his task force has got some pretty heavy-duty work to do. You know, some people would maybe make the case that we've studied this enough and it's time to act, but I guess you can never have too much information. And we should note, Rick, that one of our Central Wisconsin legislators, Katrina Shankland, a representative from Stevens Point, is the co-chair of that. So all you people out there who want to have an impact, you know who to go to, Katrina Shankland right there in Stevens Point. And so I'm hopeful on that front. I also would say that Speaker Voss has been supportive in the past of the Stewardship Fund. And I think that you're going to see some more leaders on the conservation side emerging in this new legislature at a time when we have a governor who's obviously made that a priority.
The Sistine Chapel, I've been to the Taj Mahal, to the Notre Dame Cathedral, and that great big Chinese wall, the pyramids of Egypt, the city of Angkor Vat. But the holiest place I've ever seen is Aldo Leopold Shack. Take me back to Aldo Leopold Shack, down by the Wisconsin River. There's an outhouse in the back, tulips planted on the side, eagles flying in the sky, pine trees reaching oh so high, and Aldo Leopold Shack.
Speaking of Glenn Moberg, a little bit of music that he wrote about Aldo Leopold Shack. That's all the time we have for today on Route 51. I'd like to thank our guest, Bill Berry, for joining us. Thanks to Joy Ratch-Kramer for producing today's program and for on-air production. John Altenberg composed the Route 51 theme and special music today from John Denver, Dead Horses, The Decemberists, Counting Crows, and of course, Glenn Moberg. We'll be back next week, and until then, we're heading out of town.